Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping in for, well, a pretty wild ride into a unique podcasting universe, the world of Big Fatty Online, or BFO, as most people know it.
Yeah, BFO. We're going deep on the very beginning, the first week, specifically.
Exactly. We're focusing really intensely on that chaotic, hilarious, and surprisingly structured first week back in February 2008.
It really is foundational. We're talking about six episodes dropped between February 3rd and the 8th, and right away they established the rhythm, the rules, the whole, you know, language of Big Fatty's world.
Yeah, it's like, if you want to understand the core of BFO, that mix of extreme intimacy and weirdly dedication to structure, this first week is basically BFO 101.
Absolutely. Consider this your essential guide.
So our mission today is really to give you, the listener, the definitive shortcut. We want you to be fluent in BFO culture, at least understand where it all came from.
And it starts with that core identity, that phraseology he established immediately. It's like the whole show's ethos in one sentence.
You mean
the mantra? Yeah, it's not just ruined. It's me, Big Fatty Online.
It's perfect. Yeah. It acknowledges the chaos, the messiness, but also completely owns it. That's him. That's the show.
Okay, so let's unpack the very beginning. BFO didn't exactly tiptoe onto the scene, did it?
Not at all. Hit the ground running. Episode 1 debuted Sunday, February 3rd, 2008. And the timing was, well, pretty strategic.
Right. It was dropped during halftime of the big game,
which he, of course, carefully called the Booper Soul. Even back then, you see him being aware of, like, copyright stuff, but launching it then. During the biggest TV event of the year.
Yeah, it feels like classic counter-programming. Catch everyone who's maybe bored with the game itself.
Exactly. Yeah. Get a notification, check out this new thing. It was smart.
And this wasn't his first podcast rodeo, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
BFO was a spinoff from his earlier show, the LittleFatty.com podcast.
Right, but what's interesting is how messy the transition was. The final episode of LittleFatty.com was apparently still in the works, even as BFO launched.
So it wasn't a clean break. It felt more like excitement took over, you know, less like a planned corporate handover, more like just jumping into the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the community involvement was key right from the start.
How so?
Well, getting the word out. A listener, Larry H. Vader, V-A-D-E-R, he volunteered to post that first BFO episode onto the old LittleFatty.com site.
Oh, okay. So using the old channel to announce the new one.
Precisely. It was about notifying the old listeners, making sure they knew where he'd gone. It made the launch feel really grassroots, you know, community-driven, cementing loyalty before episode one was even done.
That grassroots vibe definitely carries over into the whole technical philosophy, or maybe the anti-philosophy of the show, the no-tech approach.
Oh, yeah. The no-tech stance is crucial. It's all about authenticity, or at least projecting it.
Mm.
Big Fatty states, right up front, he generally doesn't use prepackaged sound effects.
So if you hear a noise,
it probably came out of him. That's what he says. It sets this expectation for raw, unedited, immediate content. The host is the production value.
And that rawness extends to the setting, the Fat Cave, right?
Yep, the Fat Cave, that's where it's recorded, establishes this intimate, personal space immediately.
And his whole stance on computers.
Hilarious, isn't it? He explicitly says he doesn't use the computers or the cell phones, which is, you know, ironic given he needs them for the podcast to even exist and be distributed.
It's like a running gag that also justifies the lack of polish.
Totally. It's a shield. It's not slick because I don't do tech.
And we absolutely have to talk about the launch week drama that perfectly encapsulated the show's name, the iTunes resistance.
Ah, yes. The famous finger to iTunes. It's peak BFO branding right out of the gate. Episode one launches and the website has this picture. Two fans flipping off iTunes.
Because they hadn't approved the podcast yet.
Exactly. The subscription button was literally unavailable. But instead of being purely frustrated, he leans into it, makes it part of the brand.
Ruined from the beginning.
Precisely. Defying the system before it even started properly. It was brilliant, in a way, owning the technical failure.
Okay, so before BFO could really become BFO, there was one piece of old business to clear up in that first episode.
Yeah, I had to tie up a loose end from the little fatty cast.
Yeah.
Good housekeeping, you know. Start with a clean slate.
What was it?
It was the drawing for the December Dead or Alive game winner. Scott M. from Boston won.
And the prize?
two soy candles by thieves. Fulfilling that promise, which was originally made by Michael Hipp and Larry Vader on the old show, was important. Showed respect for the old community, built trust before diving headfirst into the new thing. So once that was settled, Big Fatty immediately started laying down the structure for BFO. And this structure, this almost like military precision, is key.
It seems counterintuitive, maybe, a rigid structure for such a personal, chaotic show.
But it's not a restriction, it's the enabler. It's the framework that allowed for all the extreme personal stuff that came later.
Okay, so first steps, consistency. He set a goal, right?
Yep. Initially aimed for 3 to 5 shows per week, which is already pretty ambitious.
But he didn't just meet that.
He blew past it. Week 1, 6 episodes. Right away, he establishes this expectation of high frequency. Train the audience. BFO is a daily habit.
And that pace worked because he instantly filled it with recurring segments. Predictable slots for, well, unpredictable content.
Exactly. That's the structural genius. You know what's coming, format-wise, but not what he'll say within it.
And the very first segment we heard right in episode 1 was Memory Lane music.
Classic BFO. Plays a song, usually a TV theme, asks you to guess it, hum along, whatever. It's interactive nostalgia.
The first one was the Captain Kangaroo theme.
A favorite remake, yeah. And characteristically, he had a personal story attached, remembering the original captain messing with the sound crew by missing the hook for his keys. It's never just the music, it's his connection to the music.
And the level of detail he brought, even in week 1, was pretty intense. Episode 2, the theme from Family, he's dissecting casting changes from the 70s.
Oh, totally obsessed. He points out Elaine Hale played Nancy Lawrence first, then Meredith Baxter Burney took over, and he definitely preferred Meredith Baxter Burney.
And he singled out Christy McNichol's character.
Letitia Buddy Lawrence.
Yeah.
Called her a favorite. This isn't just casual remembering. It's like deep dive TV trivia.
Yeah.
Makes him seem like this eccentric but knowledgeable guy.
And didn't he initially mispronounce her name?
He did. Called her Letitia first. But then later that same week, corrected himself, said it was Letitia.
How did you back that up?
With another specific memory. Said Kate Lawrence, the mom, would always call her Letitia when she was mad. That self-correction loop is important. Shows he's listening, engaging with his own content, makes it feel more real time.
And the memory lane segments kept coming. Episode 4 had the theme from Angie.
Yep. And then episode 6 got even more complex. A medley of 2 Petticoat Junction themes.
Why 2?
Because, as he explained, the actress playing Kate died. So they had to bring in Uncle Joe and then June Lockhart as the Lady MD. He's basically giving a mini lecture on 1960s TV continuity changes.
Uh-huh.
Framed, again, in this really personal way.
Okay, beyond music, he also debuted a conversation segment pretty early on. The Gaze.
Episode 5. This was set up as a regular feature, a one-on-one chat with a listener. The first guest was Michael from QCast Connection.
So, signaling that actual conversation with him was part of the planned structure.
Exactly. Not just random calls, but a scheduled event. It elevates the listener interaction.
And the general call-in format had that very specific request, right? The good gosh and gay moment.
Yeah, it gave listeners clear instructions for their voice letters, as he called them. The number, 206-337-1438, was repeated often. And the prompt was threefold. Share something good. Share a gosh moment, like a surprising fact or something impressive, or bring up a gay topic to discuss or learn about.
A very defined framework for generating content.
Super specific. Directs the intimacy, in a way.
And to keep people literally connected to his physical movements, there was ruining your city.
Which is just what it sounds like.
Yeah.
He lists where he's traveling next, invites listeners to meet up for a beverage or 3.
Makes the podcast intensely personal, turns his travel into potential community meetups.
Yeah, bridges the gap between the online voice and the real person.
Now, for new listeners trying to catch up back then, a really vital segment suggested by Michelle from Cary, North Carolina, was the vocabularium. Why did BFO need its own dictionary?
Oh, the vocabularium is critical. It wasn't just a glossary. It was about inclusion. And maybe a little bit of exclusion.
How so?
By documenting the specific terms he used, the nicknames, the whole cast of characters he talked about, he created an in-group. If you knew the vocabularium you were in, you understood the references.
A linguistic membership badge.
Perfectly put. Reinforced that shared culture, made the community feel distinct and special.
And finally, rounding out the segments, he showed he was definitely listening to other podcasters with podcast poop.
Debuted in episode 4. This cemented him as this, like, peer reviewer who wasn't afraid to poke fun or criticize.
What kind of stuff did he cover?
He talked about a video from the QCast Connection guys involving chaps, Tim Cormall's kind of weird prawn chips.
Prawn chips, okay.
Yeah. But the real defining BFO moment in that first segment was when he went after the Foul Monkeys podcast, specifically Herb.
Over what?
A sports claim. Herb had apparently asserted that every state in the U.S. has a professional sports team.
Which is definitely not true.
Right. And Big Fatty didn't just say, nuh-uh. He turned it into this major research project. A teachable moment, BFO style.
So he brought receipts.
Oh, did he ever. He went through and listed 25 states that do not have a team in Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NBA, or the NHL.
Wow, 25. So basically half the states.
Pretty much. And it wasn't just about being right. It showed his personality.
Yeah.
That dedication to sometimes really obscure research just to, you know, entertainingly correct someone. It highlights the passion he brought even to seemingly off-topic stuff.
Okay, so let's dig into the actual content of that first week. The Booper Soul, the Super Bowl, was obviously the immediate hook for the first couple of shows.
Absolutely. It was a news peg. Had to cover it.
Yeah.
He congratulated the New York Giants on that massive upset win over the Patriots.
Making them 18-1. Ouch.
Yeah. Big story. Mandatory coverage.
But he also acknowledged that maybe not everyone listening cared about the game itself.
Right. He specifically said something like, most of the gays do not particularly enjoy the sports. So he quickly pivoted to the commercials, which have much broader appeal anyway.
And he gave them a full review.
Instantly. Ran down his favorites, Bud Light, especially ones claiming the beer gave you powers like breathing fire or flying.
Okay.
The FedEx Pigeons ad, the Arrayed Babies, standard water cooler talk, but filtered through his perspective.
Did he add any BFO flavor to it?
He used it to deliver a perfect gosh moment. He revealed the cost of a 30-second ad spot during the game.
How much was it back in 08?
A cool $3 million. Just dropping that fact connects the fun spectacle to this staggering financial reality. Classic Big Fatty move.
But really, the Super Bowl chat was just the appetizer. The main course, the thing that really dominated week one's content, was his true passion.
Reality television. Or as he liked to call them, quiz programs.
This was clearly his obsession.
Formed the absolute backbone of the daily content. He gave extensive, super detailed coverage to shows that were current or upcoming.
And he even had special theme music for it.
He did. Introduced it that week, the new Fat Cave theme music, created by Michael from QCast Connection. Michael apparently sent it after a horror meeting, and the music itself was really dramatic, kind of spooky. Added this layer of self-aware melodrama to his reality TV rundowns.
Okay, so which shows got the BFO treatment first?
He was hooked on Make Me a Supermodel on Bravo, called it Deliciousness.
What caught his eye?
He was particularly focused on an episode where the contestants had to pose nude for an art class.
Ah, so typical BFO territory.
Exactly. His commentary wasn't just recapping. He was dissecting it, focusing on the aesthetics, the boundary-pushing aspect.
Oh, yeah.
Blending art critique with, let's be honest, personal enjoyment.
Then there was Survivor 16, fans versus favorites. And he spent a lot of time on the cast, especially the men.
Oh, yeah. Deep dive on the male castaways.
Yeah.
Using very specific, very physical criteria. He really zoomed in on Joel the firefighter. Muscular, tattooed, Big Fatty's reaction was intense.
Yeah.
Said Joel was so hot, he'd let him beat the ass out of him.
Wow. Okay. That's direct.
That's the radical intimacy, right?
Yeah.
Personal desire becomes public commentary, no filter. But then he gave equal time to Chet, the 48-year-old contestant, who he basically called the heinous one.
So strong opinions based on looks and vibe.
Absolutely. It wasn't about game strategy yet. It was purely about the physical presence, the aesthetics of the people on his screen.
And the excitement really built for Big Brother 9, the winter edition.
He was super hyped for that, the first ever winter season.
Yeah.
And his focus immediately went to the social dynamics, specifically the casting.
What about the casting?
The confirmation that there would be at least two homosexual couples going into the house, that was big news for him. He even posted pictures online and asked listeners point blank, guess which of these men are gay?
Engaging the audience in speculation right away.
Totally. And he noted the house design nautical theme apparently only had double or queen beds, no singles.
Forcing pairings.
Making the couplings, as he called them, inevitable and more interesting for the voyeuristic aspect of the show, setting the stage for relationship drama.
This kind of content, drawn straight from his very specific, sometimes extreme interests, very quickly led into some, let's say, memorable personal disclosures and audience requests.
Memorable is one word for it.
Yeah.
By episode two, just the second show, he'd already made the request.
The infamous request.
Encouraging listeners, men and women, to send in pictures of their genitalia.
Right out of the gate. That's bold.
He was specific, too. Mentioned a preference for big balls and promised to touch myself somewhat inappropriately when he received them.
Okay, I have to ask, how was that received? Was there immediate backlash or did the community just roll with it?
From what we can tell, the core community that was forming just embraced it. It was part of the shock value, part of the BFO brand, almost instantly.
He didn't back down from it.
Nope. By episode 4, he confirmed he'd already received naked pictures. And then he refined the request, specifically asked for testicular pictures.
Why the refinements?
Apparently, to get under Superb's skin, another figure in his orbit. It was performative boundary pushing, establishing right away. This show goes there.
And the structure we talked about, the segments, the schedule that allowed this.
I think so. The predictability of the format maybe created a weird kind of safety zone for this radical, intimate, shocking content. You knew what you were tuning in for, even if what he said was unpredictable.
Interestingly, though, it wasn't all shock value in reality TV. He balanced it with moments of genuine outrage.
Yeah, the sociopolitical commentary popped up, too. The big one that week was a story out of Mississippi.
Blair.
A state legislator there was apparently trying to pass a bill making it illegal for fat people to eat out in restaurants.
Seriously.
And Big Fatty was just floored, expressed total disbelief, absolute outrage, compared the absurdity to making it illegal for stupid people to hold office.
So a moment of real passion there.
Definitely. It showed another side. Contrasted sharply with the irreverence elsewhere, revealed some deeply held personal beliefs about fairness and, well, common sense. And throughout all this, the listener community wasn't just passive. They were actively engaged, and Big Fatty made their engagement a core part of the show's machinery, especially through the website.
Right. The listener map was central to this. He made a point of differentiating it from the old ham map on the previous podcast.
Yeah, he was clearly proud of the new BFO map's immediate traction. Mentioned it had nearly 100 views before episode 1 even officially dropped. That metric was instant validation for him.
And he didn't just mention the map, he personalized it, turned listeners into characters.
Totally. He did these roll calls, like he specifically mentioned Sky from Illinois and Kellen, saying they'd called his voice sexy.
Leading to that joke.
Yeah, maybe we should change it to Big Sexy Online. He used their feedback directly, folded it right back into the show's narrative and identity.
Who else got shout-outs in that first week?
Let's see. Ricky from the Foul Monkeys podcast, Atha from New Zealand, who apparently sent an e-letter spanking later for not being mentioned sooner, even though Arthur was technically the first MAP member.
Okay, little listener drama already.
Greg from San Diego got mentioned, with Big Fatty teasing about maybe visiting him near Palm Springs in July. Jeremiah from Mississippi, probably spurred by that awful restaurant bill story. And Rebecca from Nevada, who he called a fish.
A fish?
Yeah, just one of those BFO nicknames, presumably.
Yeah.
But listing them like that, connecting them to places and little details, it makes the whole thing feel like this exclusive club you're listening in on.
And the website itself, bigfatonline.com, no WW needed, as he constantly reminded people, had its own little first week quirks.
Absolutely. The glitches kind of reinforced that whole ruined brand, like the weird German text that kept showing up on the comment submission page.
How did he handle that?
He mentioned it, and then a listener, Arthur, actually translated it for everyone. Turned a technical bug into this little community collaboration moment.
Nice. And he was also pushing downloads from the site.
Yeah, the BFO postcard, which he called the electric ham holder.
The electric ham holder. Okay.
Yep. Just another piece of unique BFO vocabulary. But yeah, pushing that download, reminding people of the voice letter line, the segment formats, it was all about embedding the show's rituals and reinforcing the brand, even giving it a slightly old school tangible feel, despite being digital. And week 1 wrapped up with him summarizing the voice letters he'd received, which proved the format was working immediately.
Who called in?
Tim Cormall called about the madness at Costco right before the Super Bowl. Eric the Southern Boy called to share his newfound obsession with Make Me a Supermodel, thanks to Big Fatty.
So direct influence there.
Yeah. And Michael from QCast Connection called in, praising that Fat Cave theme music he'd just created. It completed the loop. Show content leads to listener action, which becomes show content again.
What really strikes me looking back at that first week is just how immediate the success felt. And it seems like it was driven by that combination of hyper-consistency and, well, radical self-exposure.
The engagement numbers were pretty remarkable for a podcast back in early 2008. He mentioned getting 17 comments before the test show even aired, then 29 on the test show itself, 8 on episode 1 proper.
That's a lot of interaction right away.
It really is. And that immediate high volume of comments and support was clearly the feedback loop he needed. It encouraged him to push even harder, to aim for that daily weekday show almost immediately.
He explicitly credited the audience too, didn't he?
Oh yeah. Said something like, "You're making the fat one happy and you're making the fat man want to try to do this every weekday." It underscores how much BFO felt like a co-creation, driven by the audience validating his very specific, very personal style.
And he didn't waste any time setting the stage for the next week either. He gave it a theme right away.
Yep, week two was immediately dubbed VD Week, Valentine's Day Week, running February 11th to the 15th. And with that theme came an immediate, pretty high-stakes call to action for the listeners.
What was the task?
Listeners had to show the love. The requirement was either tell someone completely new about BFO, get a new listener hooked, or call the voice letter line just to wish him a happy VD.
Ah, happy VD.
Right. But he stressed it wasn't just a suggestion. He framed it like the show literally wouldn't work, wouldn't continue if they didn't stay in touch, if they didn't do their part.
Makes the listener feel essential. Turns listening into participation.
Exactly. It solidifies the structure. The audience has a role. They have agency. They are necessary for this thing to exist. It's a brilliant way to build loyalty and ensure content flow.
So if we try to connect all these threads, it brings up kind of an interesting point analytically. BFO established this incredibly strict, rigid structure in just 1 week. You had the 20-minute rule he mentioned trying to stick to, the daily schedule, the named segments like memory lane music, the ritual check-ins like the listener map.
Super structured, yeah.
Yet it's precisely that rigidity, that predictable framework that seems to be the canvas allowing him to share these incredibly raw, intensely intimate, often hilarious, sometimes shocking details about his life, his body, his opinions.
I think that's exactly right. The predictability is the safety net. Knowing the segment is coming, knowing the show has this rhythm, knowing the audience is tuned in and participating in this structured way. It seems to grant him the security or maybe the permission to just go there.
Go there with the nude picture requests, the unfiltered body commentary, the deep dives on reality TV guys.
All of it. The structure creates a ritual, and the ritual builds a strange kind of trust between him and the dedicated listener. The consistency isn't a limitation. It's the bedrock that enables the radical honesty.
Which leaves us with a final thought, maybe, for you, the listener. Big Fatty essentially built this entire world by taking the consistent, predictable parts of his life, his niche hobbies, his TV watching habits, his tech frustrations, and turning them into reliable daily content slots. It makes you wonder, what predictable parts of your own daily life, your routines, your work could actually be the consistent canvas for your own form of connection or expression? Sometimes that structured commitment is the secret ingredient that allows the really raw, personal, and ultimately memorable stuff to actually come out.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.